What?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. It's a good topic. But before we get to the actual topic of the night, I feel I would be remiss if I didn't at least make mention of the situation in Israel right now. It's a dangerous, very precarious situation, and I'm not going to go on any soapbox about anything political or like that, but I think it's smart to at least maybe present one aspect from a Torah perspective. I don't have the answers, but there's a fascinating Mishnah, and it's more not so much describing the situation or what we can do about it, but what's our reaction during a time of crisis. That's really what I want to speak just for a few moments, because that's really the situation. It is a crisis situation in Israel, and I think any person with their eyes open to history and certainly to the current situation realizes it's not limited to a small little piece of land. This has global ramifications. This is not just a small little local conflict between two biker gangs in Los Angeles. I mean, this is being played out on the world stage. So there's a fascinating Mishnah. The Mishnah describes about certain creatures. We know that the Torah tells us that they're in the laws of Tumah and Tahara, about purity and impurity, spiritual purity. There are certain laws as it pertains to land animals as opposed to sea creatures. The laws are not exactly the same if one comes in contact with one of them. So the question that the Mishnah is dealing with a whole long list of various creatures, what are its status? So the Mishnah states that all items that come from fish or other sea creatures cannot be rendered impure except for one. And it's called in Hebrew, it's called Kelev Shebeyam. Literally means the dog of the sea. That's the name that it's given. That creature, that is not considered a sea creature, but rather it has the status of a land animal. And the Talmud, and they want to discuss, like, why is that? What makes this so unique? So the Mishnah states that the reason why this creature, the Kelev Shebeyam, the dog of the sea, is not considered a sea creature is because when it is in danger, it flees from the water and goes up on dry land. Okay, and therefore what? The commentators point out that despite its habitat is mostly most of the time in the water, in the sea, it is a land animal. Why? So Reb Tzadok explains that you determine the true character. Watch somebody during the time of crisis. What does a person do? There are certain people, when they get to a crisis in their life, their reaction is they get drunk. They go to a bar and they drink away their problem, pretending to drink away their problem. Others in crisis mode, they become extremely anxious and they can't deal with anything and they become paralyzed by their situation. Others are able to be leaders and compartmentalize and say, okay, I'm worried about this crisis, but I need to go and be active. I need to do something about it. People react differently. Reb Tzadok from Lublin wants to suggest that when you want to know about the true character of somebody, watch him or her in a time of crisis. What do they do? What does a businessman do when his profits are down and he's presented with an opportunity to cheat, get away with something on his taxes, or not to report something, or to not give exactly perfect measurements? You know, I always wondered how it is that certain brands of soda for the longest time remained the same price. How did they do it without dealing with inflation, without dealing? The answer is very simple. They stopped filling the bottle to the top. And if you do that on 100,000 or 1 million bottles of soda, you save a boatload of money. The bottle still says 2 liter, but you're not getting 2 liters anymore. Or the other opportunity is you charge the same price, but you, instead of doing it as a 2 liter, you do it as a 1.5 liter. Now that's not cheating. That's how they're dealing with the pricing. But what does the businessman do when their profits are down versus the opportunity to lie? What does a person do when someone is seriously ill in their family? Do they just talk to doctors, or do they actually reach out and pray a little bit more? What does a person do when their brothers and sisters in the land of Israel are in danger? What do? Yes, maybe they give extra money to charity to help, but do they learn a little extra Torah? Do they offer a sincere prayer to God? What do we do? Do we make a stronger commitment to something Jewish? Rav Tzadok suggests that that is the reason why this creature has the status of a land animal, even though most of the time it spends its time in the water. Because when it's under pressure and it's in crisis, where does it go? It doesn't hide out in the water. It goes back on land. And therefore, that's the true nature of the creature. It's really essentially a land animal. The same should be true for us. When we're facing and we're reading the news, thank God it's not here in our backyard. But it is. These are our brothers. These are our sisters. I don't know about you, but I couldn't believe the news on Sunday about the collapsed bleachers. I don't know if you heard about this. There was a celebration. It's like the people, they just can't catch a break right now. So what are we doing about it? We read the news and we conjecture this and we conjecture that, and we point fingers at this and we point fingers at that, and we claim this and we... But what are we doing about it? We're in crisis mode. Where do we run? The answer is we get on a Zoom call and we learn. We offer an extra prayer. We do something in real terms, because that's at the essence of who we are. That's what we have to keep in mind. I don't know the answers to the political quagmire that we're in. I don't know. But I do know that as a Jew who believes 100% that this is all part of God's plan somehow, some way, that it's my responsibility and to react to a crisis situation by doubling down on what I know to be true, whether it's my Torah observance, my mitzvah observance, my prayer, something. That's my reaction to all of this. And that's just my thought in terms of what we can do from afar. Okay. That being said, we go back to our parsha. And our parsha this week is the longest parsha in the Torah. It's 176 verses. That's pretty long. For any bar mitzvah boy, that's a big undertaking. Parshat Naso. But it's a good news, bad news story. The bad news, it's the longest one. The good news is that the last few aliyot are exactly the same. There's only a couple of word differences. It repeats itself over and over and over again about the gifts that the 12 tribal leaders brought in the inauguration. Okay. But stuck in the middle, that often gets glossed over, is the story of the Nazir, the Nazirite. Very, very unique story and situation in the Torah. Most of us probably have heard of the famous story about Samson. Samson, where do we know about him? Oh, he had long hair. Okay, that is true. But that's not the essence of the story of a Nazir, of a Nazirite. What is the story? So basically, it's a person who takes upon him or herself the vow that they're going to be a Nazirite, to refrain from any grape product, wine, grape juice, eating the pips from grapes, seeds, any of that stuff. They stay away from that. In addition, they are forbidden to become contaminated, impure, by coming in contact with the dead. They can't go to a funeral. They can't go to a cemetery. Those are the two main aspects. But in addition, what has become Hollywood is that, yes, they let their hair grow long. Now, there are different laws, different kinds of Nazirites. I'm actually my study partner who I learn with. I'm learning together with him probably 10 years, maybe 11 years already. That's the section of Talmud we've been studying the last few months. There's an entire tractate called Nazir, the Nazirite. It's much more complex than I had bargained for. It was not what I thought. I had never done it before, though. So I figured, you know what? I'm 100 years old. It's time to learn it. So that's what we're doing. And it's complicated. But here's what's interesting. The Torah does tell us that what happens to this fellow who now comes upon, he didn't purposely go to a cemetery. He's walking along, or he goes to visit someone in the hospital, and all of a sudden the guy in the hospital dies and he's in the room. And now, okay, he becomes impure. He becomes tameh. So there's a whole procedure of what he has to do to now get out of that impurity and how to go through the process of purification. At some point, he finishes his term of Nazirite. How long is it typically? Anybody know? It can be anywhere. It can be from, you know, a week to 100 years. It can be his lifetime. But if he doesn't specify, anybody know what the default days are? 30 days. 30 days. If you don't specify, then you have a month. 30 days. That's the default mode, unless you specify otherwise. So we read in the Torah, in this week's parsha, we read the following. This shall be the law of the Nazirite on the day his abstinence is completed, right? He abstained from wine. He abstained from becoming impure. So when his term is completed, he shall bring himself to the entrance of the tent of meeting. He shall come to the temple. He shall bring his offering to Hashem, one sheep in its first year, as an elevation offering, and it goes through the whole list. Now, in English, it seems pretty straightforward. When his term is up, he shall bring himself to the entrance of the tent of meeting. How would you have written it? He should
go
or come. He should bring himself. That's like going like this when you want to scratch your ear. Just say he should come to the tent of meeting and this is what he should bring. It gets even worse because in the Hebrew, there's too many pronouns. Here's what it says. V'zot tarat ha-nazir. This is the law regarding the Nazirite. B'yom melot yemei nizro. On the day that he completes his Nazirite vow. Yavi oto. He shall bring him el petach omoe to the entrance of the tent of meeting. He shall bring him. Now, Art Scroll did you the favor and translated it for you and said he shall bring himself. But the literal words in the Torah are, he shall bring him to the end. Who is he? Who's bringing whom? Doesn't say, it almost sounds as if there's a third party involved. He should bring him. Who's him? It's very unclear. And if you throw in on top of it, the Torah itself never gives a prescribed length of the period of being a Nazir. Our sages, as I told you, tell us that if he doesn't specify, it's 30 days, but the text of the Torah, you won't find it anywhere. Does not suggest any recommended length of time. Why? Tell me, if you want to be a Nazirite, here's what you do. You do this for 30 days. You do this for a year. It just leaves it completely open-ended. Why? Seems a little strange. So to really appreciate this, I'll ask one more question. Just on a simple basis, you can give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. The guy or gal who makes him or herself a Nazirite, good thing or not good thing? What would you vote? Thumbs up if you think he's doing a good thing. Thumbs down if you think he's doing not such a good thing. And then you have those who have the thumb right in the middle because you have no idea what
it could be, good or bad.
Yeah. It's neither good nor bad, or you don't know, and therefore you're just playing politically correct and staying in the middle.
I think it could be good and bad.
Okay, explain. Busted.
I just think it could be both. It could be beneficial and non-beneficial.
Okay. Why do you think it's beneficial?
Oh, because they're doing something. He's doing something to serve God, you know, to go to the entrance, to go through the process.
But that's only at the end of his term. It's okay. There's a procedure of how he gets out of it. But should he have made this vow of Nazarite in the first place? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? You don't know. I didn't give you enough information.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah. TLI. Maybe. It's TLI, too little information. What do you say, Michelle?
Well, maybe the person decides to be a Nazarite because he feels that there's some kind of lacking in his character, and that by doing this, it's going to help him be closer and be able to rejoin the group of non-Nazarites.
Okay, so you vote in favor that it's a good thing.
The man or person who decides they're going to do it, they have to decide why they're doing it.
Okay.
And so if they're doing it to get closer, because they feel that there's something lacking and they need to do this to help them achieve whatever it is they're trying to, then it's a good thing.
Okay.
But if you're doing it to separate for no other reason other than to, you know.
Okay. So let me ask you.
I'm going to be this kind of person.
If you were writing the rules, if you were writing the rules of how he completes his term, would you have him bring a sin offering as one of his offerings? By default. You would say it depends, right? If he did it for a good motivation, then fine. If not, then yeah, he brings a sin offering. But the Torah gives a prescribed, an entire step-by-step procedure. He's to bring one Ola offering. He's supposed to bring this. And one of the offerings that he must bring under all circumstances is a sin offering to ask forgiveness for violating a sin.
So maybe the act of separating himself from the other Jews is not a good thing.
Okay, so now you've changed your mind and now you're going 180. Now you're not, now it's a thumbs down. But here's a problem. If you read the text, Michelle, the Torah itself calls it, he's called Kodesh Lashem, the Holy One to God. Oh, that sounds like a good thing. Man, I hope they write that on my epitaph one day.
But so see, make I have, up your still mind. Have a problem.
What?
I said I still have a problem. But go ahead, Michelle.
I was going to say, well, the individual chooses to be a Nazareth. So it should be he chooses when he's going to stop doing it, when he feels like he's accomplished what he needs to accomplish. But the fact that he separates himself from the rest of the Jews is not a good thing.
Okay. I'll hold on to that thought. I'll come back.
So, you know.
I'm with you. Go ahead. Eliane, what's the question?
I guess the part I'm trying to reconcile is the most famous person who was a Nazarite was Samson. But if I recall correctly, Samson did not choose to be a Nazarite. That was a promise that his mother made to the angel.
Well the angel or, told her. The angel,
her angel told her that he was going to be.
Well, that's a pretty good prescription when you get the word of God to say that the baby inside should be a Nazarite. That's a pretty good indication.
Yeah, but if I recall correctly, she wasn't able to get pregnant until the angel, she got pregnant,
true.
And the angel said, by the way, he's going to be a Nazarite.
That's correct. I mean,
and
I don't
there
know about,
was no term limit specified.
So good. Excellent. So Samson was a unique case. That is correct. In the Talmud that I'm studying, it does describe the Nazarite of Shimshon of Samson as a different kind. That was an eternal one. That was a full lifetime. That is true. The Joe, okay, the average Joe Nazarite would be, unless he specifies 100 days or 6 years, it's 30 days. That's the default. Okay? But here, okay, but Shell said something very interesting. And that is, what prompts this guy to take it upon himself? I don't know about you. For me, there are enough restrictions in the Torah already. The Torah says there are certain things I can't have. Okay. And I've come to grips with it. But there's a long list of do's and there's a long list of do nots. This guy comes along and says, you know what? I know it. I know the Torah says I can have wine in moderation. I know the Torah says I can go ahead and, if need be, go to a funeral and seminar, but I'm not going to do it. What prompts a guy to do that? What is his issue? There's not enough that the Torah prohibits already that you take upon yourself more? So the Talmud is discussing this and says the following. And I think it's a good framework in which that we can present this. We all face challenges in our life. What I mean by that is that we live our lives and we cannot be on a constant pattern of growth. Yes, overall, we want growth and we push ourselves to improve, but it's like the stock market. It goes up some days and it goes down some days. And some days we're good and some days we're in gear and some days we slide a little bit. That's normal. That's normal. That's the way life is meant to be. And the goal is that when we start life down here and we end life up here, hey, it's like the stock market. If you invested down here and you ended up here, even though you had lots of ups and downs and some higher, some low, but the bottom line is you ended higher than you started. Congratulations, you lived a successful life. This guy, he's facing some hard internal challenges. He's having a really tough time. He finds perhaps that he's hanging out with the wrong crowd. Maybe he's finding himself too much engaged with the physical pleasures of this world. And he's having a hard time. I will raise my hand and say, I struggle because I need to lose some weight. I know I need to do it. But every night I sit down, I'm saying, okay, but I enjoy lasagna. But I enjoy this. And I should stop after one piece, but no, I wouldn't want to insult my wife. Come on, you know. So for me, it's a challenge. I know I should be doing it, right? So what should I do? I can convince myself every day that I'm going to be better. But here it is, almost a year and a half since COVID started. And instead of what should have been a great opportunity to lose weight, guess what? I know, shocker of all shockers, I put on weight. So what are my options? Keep banging, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, and maybe I will. But at some point, I wake up and I say, I have to do something a little bit more drastic. I have to be serious about this. That's it. I am making a commitment, no more sugar, no more carbs, no more whatever it is. I don't know, pick your own diet, whatever works, right? And you make a commitment. That's it. I will not. Not I'm going to try, but I'm staying away. I'm vowing. I'm swearing off all fruits and vegetables. No, all candy. That's it. No more Shabbos treats. Okay. This guy in the Torah is facing that internal struggle. He finds himself partaking too much of the physical world, and he's battled his Yetzirah on and off and on and off, and he's done this for who knows how long, and he feels he needs something a little bit more potent as a corrective measure. So he takes upon himself short term, leave Samson out for a moment, he wants to have a short term. You see, if I convinced myself, and I really could, that I will be careful for 30 days, give me the 30-day weight challenge. I can do it. It's where I say, that's it. I'm really going to exercise going forward, and I'm going to be really good about it with no end in sight. Then, all right, tomorrow, the next day, or I'll do it one day. I'm like, oh man, that was tough. Thank goodness I have an early meeting tomorrow, you know? But if you set a short term, it's almost like a boost. It's a boost. He wants to take upon himself an injection of spiritual oomph for a short term. That's a good thing. For the most part, his objective is good. Michelle, like you said, the reason why he's doing it is for a very good reason. He's motivated. He really wants to make a change. He's trying to battle some of his inner weaknesses. You know what? You cannot truly, the Torah cannot predict exactly how long that's going to take. For one person, it may be 2 weeks. For one person, it may be 6 weeks. For one person, it may be 6 months. You don't know. The Torah cannot put in writing and say that if you take a vow of a Nazarite, it's going to be for X number of days. You don't know. The Torah can't prescribe it. Comes along the sages and they say, by default, if a person is focused, he can do something in 30 days. Try it for 30 days. I find it fascinating. Like they always tell you these products, try it free for 30 days. If you don't like it, money back. Why 30 days? Because it's a normal period of time to become familiar with the product. It's not a week. You know, you don't know if the product, yeah, maybe I didn't get around to using it this week. 30 days is a fair amount of time to be able to check. Is it therapeutic? Is it not? Is it working? Is it not? So the Torah can't prescribe it. Each person's, background circumstances will differ from the next. So listen to what the Torah, look at the genius here. How does a person know when they've reached their goal of spiritual climbing? How do they know they've reached the goal or not? That's it. He's never going to go out and party with his friends again. That's not fair. That's not realistic. How does he know when he's freed himself from the grip of the Yetzer Hara that seems to have him right now? The answer is our verse. The verse tells us when he can take him, who's him? Himself. When he can look himself in the mirror and say, can I do this without the crutch? Can I look myself in the mirror and bring myself into, so to say, the tent of meeting? Am I spiritually charged enough? Did I get enough of a boost from that short-term infusion or not? The Torah's terminology, I'll read it to you again. This shall be the law of the Nazarite. On the day his absence is completed, Yavi Oto, he shall bring him, he shall bring himself as if, and this is the key point, as if he were an objective third party looking at the scene. Oh, what an insight. What an amazing insight. When we look at ourselves, we always see the best. We always see the positives. We almost never see our flaws. But your neighbor, oh my gosh, I can write a book on his flaws. Oh man, everything. That dog is out there from 4 a.m. until 11 o'clock at night, every single day. Not yours, Sharon, the other dog, right? And we can find, and he does this, and he doesn't put his garbage all the way in the garbage can, and the raccoons in the neighborhood are all because he does. We can find the faults in others so easily. But ourselves? What? Me? What are you talking about? Come on. They don't call me Rabbi T for nothing. Right? We are so quick to recognize the faults of others and so difficult to see our own flaws. Our pasuk, our verse is telling us that when he's able to look at himself and his own needs as objectively as if he were looking at an unrelated third party, and he can really look at himself that way, then he knows he's arrived. Then he knows that his term of the Nazarite period is successful and he's ready to be integrated back. But he has to be able to do that. It's an artificial device. There's no question about it. Becoming the Nazarite is an artificial way of giving himself a short-term boost. You know when the Nazarite work is done? When he can stand outside of himself, as it were. Look at his needs as if they were looking at someone else. Can I look at myself objectively and say, no, I'm still struggling. Maybe I should do this 30 more days. Let me be honest with myself. Yes, you know, when I get on the scale and it says -4, I should pat myself on the back. That's great. But don't stop, because -4 is not where you need to be. Maybe -24, but 4 is a good start. Don't pat yourself and say, I did it. I can't wait to go celebrate by eating ice cream. The Nazarite has to be honest and objective with himself. He has to work on his own self-awareness that he can recognize as if he were looking at someone else, where it's so much easier to see that way. Be able to look at yourself. Now, it is not easy. It is not easy seeing the flaws within ourselves. I referenced the following. We talked about this once. You have the story of the Tzara'at, right? The fellow who gets this skin malady, which in Hebrew we call it Tzara'at. In English, they translate it as leprosy. It's not really, but whatever. Well, the whole process is interesting. The person gets this skin disorder on their skin somewhere. What's the rule? The rule is, the Torah says, you have to bring it to a Kohen. The Kohen is the one who will look at it and either quarantine you or determine it's fine or determine it's not fine. The whole procedure. Yeah? What happens if the fellow who gets Tzara'at is a Kohen? Can he rule on his own Tzara'at? Yay or nay, Randy?
No.
The answer is absolutely no. Why? He can do it about anyone else. He's a Kohen. He's qualified. The answer, the Torah says, is that yes, you may be technically qualified, but you can't see your own blemishes. It's such a great phrase in the Talmud. The Talmud says all blemishes a man can see except for his own. You can't. We are born, and our nature is such that we see ourselves through rose-colored glasses. We do.
Except therefore, some of us see ourselves worse than where we really are.
Yes, and that's
also
true.
Becomes a problem if you're doing that Nazarite thing, because then you get to those 30 days and you may have made progress, but if you don't see it in yourself, you're going to keep going, and that
fabulous.
Ends up being unhealthy.
Fabulous. Elian, excellent. It works on both extremes. He has to be able to look at it objectively, the same he would about a third party. You can see that, and you can see the other side. The Talmud uses an expression. I want you to remember this. Ein adam mesim atzmo rasha. A person should not make themselves out to be wicked. It doesn't mean don't become wicked. It means don't view yourself as a wicked individual, as an evil person. Why? Because then it will become self-fulfilling prophecy. You're like, what's the point? I'm hopeless. I'm never going to improve. I'm never going to lose the weight. You're right. It's on both extremes. But it's such a great, what a great lesson from this Jewish law. We know Tzara'at comes from one of various sins, right? So why does he have to go to a Kohen? Because the Kohen is the one who can objectively point out, here perhaps is where you need to improve. When he looks at himself in the mirror, he may not see it. Therefore, you need a third party to look at it.
Well,
good. Why specifically a Kohen? Another topic. But that is what needs. You need a third party to look at you, because you cannot, you have it more difficult to see yourself objectively. Randy.
How are you supposed to do teshuva then? If you can't see it, how do you do teshuva?
So I'll get there at the end. I'll give you one bit of advice. I'll get there. Okay. But I think that the lesson that the Kohen has to get another Kohen's view reinforces the concept, no matter how knowledgeable you are, you need someone else's take on it. My best friend in the world is the one who gives me the most constructive criticism.
Yep.
Her name is Mrs. T.
That's the definition of a friend.
That's exactly what I end with. That's the last line, Randy. That's exactly the point. We need to have objective onlookers because we're not objective with ourselves. We're not. Like I said before, it's easy to find fault in others, right? But we barely see the major flaws in us. We notice one tiny little pimple on a guy and we're missing the massive wart right there on the front of our head. I mean, we don't even see it. That's the way it goes. So why is it so difficult to see? So I'll share with you one more idea that fits right into this. We know that the Torah tells us that a judge is not allowed to accept a bribe, right? That's for a very simple reason. A judge has to remain impartial, remain fair and objective. And a bribe is tilting the scales in one way over another. But why? Why is it? Why can't I remain objective even though I got something? Why? Why can't I? Isn't remaining objective an intellectual process? It's not an emotional thing. It's intellectual. So why can't I remain intellectually, academically distant from the bribe? The bribe is a nice, he likes me. It's wonderful. Okay, now let me change gears. Now I have a case to rule. And now, okay, I don't know. People seem to be compartmentalized many things in life and they can just switch gears. So why is it so terrible that the guy accepts a bribe? So the Talmud tells us a great word. Do you know what the Hebrew word for bribe is? The Torah's word for a bribe is shochad. S-H-O-C-H-A-D, shochad. Shochad, it's a very strange word. The Talmud is bothered by, like, what kind of word is shochad? He can't even find the root of the word. So the Talmud says because it's a play on words. Shehu chad, you become one. You become one with the person who just gave you the bribe. You cannot see it objectively anymore. You may be the smartest, you may be the nicest, and you may be the guy who can compartmentalize anything, but you will not see it 100% objectively anymore because you see yourself in him and him in you. That's what a bribe does. Shehu chad, you become one with the guy. That's a fact. The Torah says it doesn't matter who you are. Imagine for a moment, Moses and Aaron come to court. The great Moshe and Aaron. By the way, they are?
Brothers.
Brothers. They come to court and they testify. They testify that Rabbi T owes $100 to Elion. I think last time I took the money from you, this time I'm giving it back. Okay? They testify in court. Sandy, you believe them? This is Moses and Aaron. You believe them, right? Absolutely, positively not. You cannot. If you are the judge in the case, you have to throw the case out. They are forbidden. You cannot accept testimony from two relatives. They cannot be the two witnesses. Why? You mean to tell me one's going to lie for the other? Moses and Aaron? The answer is it may be deep down somewhere in their subconscious, but brother stands up for brother. And where Aaron may have seen the whole thing, Moses saw most of it, but if Aaron said he saw the whole thing, come on, Aaron's not going to lie. You cannot accept their testimony. Yeah, fact. Because the minute you change the equation and you have less than 100% absolute objectivity, it cannot be ruled in a court. No can do. I had a very interesting case. At my son's wedding, I wanted to give an honor to my mechutin, my other son's in-law, my daughter's in-law. It's complicated. You guys all know what a mechutin is? There's no such term in English. I'll give it to you very simply. My daughter, Brachi, married Shalom Zenworth. That's his name, okay? So Shalom's father, Rabbi Zenworth, and I
are
mechutanim. He is my mechudin.
Okay.
There's like, no English
like Makatanas.
It's my son, it's my kids' in-laws.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
There is no term in English. Yeah, it's Yiddish. Yeah, machatenister is the female.
Yiddish, right.
The mechudin is the male. The machatenister is the female.
Together, they're machatanam.
Together, they're machatanam. Okay. But there's no, it's just an amazing concept. There is no relationship like that in anywhere else. In every other, it's just, you know, it's my kids' in-laws.
Right.
No. But in a Jewish perspective, we're all mishpacha, we're all family. That's how it goes. Anyway, so the question was as follows. Can I give at my son's wedding, can I give Rabbi Zenworth, Shalom's father, the honor of signing the ketubah?
No. Right?
Technically, we're not related. Technically, we have no official relationship. Yes, mechutanim, but that's not a real relationship, or so I thought. The officiating rabbi, when I told him who I want to do what, he said, no, I'm not in favor. Because from our perspective, you're related. What do you mean? We're not really related. Yeah, but we are. And therefore, any kind of testimony, which is what signing the ketubah is, it's a witness that this contract is legit. I so-and-so sign it, that they are a married couple, blah, blah. He says, this is under Jewish law. This is testimony that's too close of a relationship, and I don't want him to do it. Can you imagine? Yeah, because that's what it means. Even if it's a 0.00001%, yeah, that means it's not 100% objective. Would he potentially stand up and defend me if I, yeah, because that's the relationship we have. Then it's not objective. The Talmud goes through many, many stories. Many, many stories. I'll read you one interesting one. The Talmud in Ketubot tells the following story about bribes that are not financial in nature, but if it's not 100% objective, then it's slanted and we won't do it. Listen to this. In the old days, they used to have what was called a sharecropper. It means somebody worked the field, and instead of getting paid, it was their field, and they would give a percentage to the owner of the field. That was like the payment of the lease. So the sharecropper who leased the orchard of Rabbi Yishmael was accustomed to bring him a basket of the orchard's fruit every Friday, right? He got fresh fruit for Shabbos. Wasn't on my diet, but may have been on Rabbi Yishmael's diet. Okay, fine. One day, the sharecropper brought it to him on a Thursday. Thursday, Rabbi Shmuel asked him, why is today different? Why this week, all of a sudden, you're bringing it on Thursday? So the sharecropper told him, I have a lawsuit to be tried in your court, and Mondays and Thursdays are typical days of when the courts were open. So I figured, I said, on my way to the court, I'll bring you the basket of fruit. Rabbi Shmuel did not accept it from him. He wouldn't take the basket. And he told him, I'm disqualified from rendering judgment for you. I cannot be the judge in this case. I must recuse myself. He appointed a different pair of rabbis to go on the court, who began to try the sharecropper's case for him. As Rabbi Yishmael was going back and forth, he must have been outside the courtroom and hearing some of the arguments for and against, and whatever the case was, he kept saying to himself, oh, if only the sharecropper would do, he would make this claim. Or if he wants, he could do this claim. Like, he found himself rooting for the sharecropper. Like, man, if I were your defense attorney, I would say this and I would defend. And he found himself rooting for the sharecropper. Upon realizing his bias towards the sharecropper, he made the following declaration. May the souls of those who accept bribes suffer agony. For now, if I, who didn't take what was offered to me, and even if I would have taken it, it would have been my own property I was taking, right? This was my payment for what he owes me anyway. He's not giving me more than my fair share. Still, I'm nevertheless influenced to such an extent that those who do accept bribes all the more so must realize they are being influenced. Can you imagine? The whole story comes down to the guy did him, quote unquote, a favor by getting it to him a day early, and he completely found himself biased. Yeah. We don't even realize it. So what's the advice? What can we do to avoid perhaps the clouding of our ability to see ourselves objectively? The Mishnah tells us exactly what Randy said. The Mishnah says, Kane lecha chaver, acquire for yourself a friend. Make sure you have somebody. And a friend does not mean a yes man. That's not a friend.
No.
That is not a true friend. A true friend is somebody who cares enough about you that will be willing to point out what your mistakes are. To point out, it's easy to be a yes man. You can be friends with anybody then. Oh, you're great. You're awesome. Fabulous. That doesn't mean anything. A friend is somebody who is able to point out where you're doing something improper. Your friend doesn't want you to do that because he cares. That's a real friend. Whether it's a spouse, a family member, or just a friend, you have to have somebody that can give you that honest assessment, whether you like it or not. That's the only way we can truly stay objective. If we were left to our own devices, we would not. We naturally do not like to see our flaws. And therefore, this Nazir, this Nazirite, how does he know how long to do this? How does he know when it's time for his completion of his term? If he can bring himself, right? This backwards way, right? Doesn't say bring himself. It says he should bring him as if someone's bringing. Yeah. The objective onlooker, if he can be able to look himself in the mirror and do that and see himself objectively, then he knows he's done right. That's how the Nazirite works. It's not something that is encouraged on a regular basis. That's why the Talmud actually says he brings a sin offering because, as the Talmud says in classic rabbinic humor, what? The Torah didn't forbid enough for you? Yeah, you want more? Enjoy. The world is meant to enjoy. Have wine for Kiddush. Don't go overboard. Use, don't abuse. But you have to take it to an extent that you take a vow of abstinence. That's not a normal path in growth of Torah. Okay, short term, yes, but not long term. That's really the idea. Being able to see ourselves objectively is very difficult. And that's why it's good to have somebody who will help you along that. You look perplexed, Robin.
I am a little bit, just because I'm going back to Randy's question about teshuvah and how you can do teshuvah if you're not seeing yourself objectively. I'm still trying to figure that part out.
So what's the answer?
A friend can tell you, and then you try to see yourself, but I'm not.
That's one way. Or, what? In addition, work on yourself to be honest. You'll never be 100% objective about yourself. It's against human nature. We are biased. That is a fact. But can you work on yourself to be honest? Like, I know, right? I have certain triggers. Everybody has certain triggers that either gets us in trouble or gets us into issues, or we say things we shouldn't. Certain buzzwords, it gets me off the rails, right? You got to know your triggers. Be honest, right? I know I have a sweet tooth. I mango is just not good for me. Just kidding, right? You have to know yourself. The more you are willing to look and see the wart in the mirror, the more likely it is you can do teshuva. Gotcha. It helps to have somebody to help you along the way. Nobody wants somebody who's there. I don't think it's going to be a great profession for anyone to consider to become a professional rebuker. You're not going to get too many clients. You may get one or two to get started, but your business is DOA. Hear that all day?
But there are some people that will tell you what's wrong.
For free. Right. They're happy to tell you your mistake.
Oh, yeah.
But Randy, you get what you pay for also.
Yeah, that's true.
but Robin, your question is real, that we can do teshuva when we're honest with ourselves. having a friend, having someone help you along those lines is very helpful. But at the end of the day, it has to be you. You have to be able to look at yourself and say, I need to improve with this. I speak too much Lashon Hara. I have to be careful with what I say, with what I do. I have to be honest. And maybe it means that I have to dedicate once a week reading from the book of, you know, a proper speech for 15 minutes a night. I mean, I have people, that's their daily learning. There are great books out there in English. That's their day. They read one page a day. And it's a constant reminder. Think about what you're saying. Should I say this about so-and-so? No, I should not. Let me work on this. Will I be perfect? No, but I'm working to correct it. That's how we do teshuva. Looking ourselves. Go ahead, Randy. Sorry.
Is there a point where we are too critical of ourselves?
So that's what Elion was talking about. Yes, you can get to a point of where you see yourself so horrible and just like, forget it. There's no point in trying anymore. That's also not good. Ein Adam Mesim Atzmo Rasha. A person should not make themselves out to be evil. That's not who you are. Yes, you make mistakes. Yes, there are things you need to correct, but that doesn't qualify as wicked, as evil. You're human.
Mm-hmm.
Pull yourself up by the bootstraps and let's do it. We can do it, but you got to be objective on both extremes. Not that I don't have the flaw and not that my flaw is so great that it's hopeless. Neither one is healthy.
I was also just going to make a point about being a Shavuot and how the Torah is still, you know, relevant today. It's 100% true in my practice with law that they always bring a family member to support them to say, this didn't happen or this did happen. And the judge never listens to the family member because they're too biased, except in rare cases, and I've had this happen twice, where the family member goes against what the person says. So the person says, I didn't abuse the child. And the family member says, I hate to say this, but I saw that they did abuse it. And then that's given great weight because they're going against their nature.
Right. Right.
So it happens. I mean, it's where I'm really living today.
You're 100% right. It is natural tendencies. To me, I always say this. The Torah is not a book about others. The Torah is a book about us. It's the inner mechanics of us as human beings. It's not the this and that. You know, the famous Mishnah that says that the world stands on three pillars. On Torah, on Avodah, divine service, and good deeds, right? And kindness. So they represent the three relationships we have in life. The good deeds, the kindness is between man and his fellow. Divine service is between man and God. Then what's Torah? I've already covered everything. No, you're right, Sharon. It's man's relationship with himself. That's what Torah is. Torah is the objective look within ourselves and say, what makes a human being tick? What are we susceptible to? What do we have to be careful about? How can I do things in my life that will help me succeed? And what are things I need to avoid? That's what it is. It's man's relationship with himself. So this story of the Nazir is exactly telling us, try to learn to be objective regarding yourself, as difficult and biased as we are. All right, next week. Next week, we have one more Wednesday night class for next week's portion, which I believe worrying leads to trouble. Worrying leads to trouble. Oh, boy, does it do. Oh, yes. Worrying.
That one now.
I'm worried about my children in Israel.
Yes. Right. But I'll show you this. Worrying does not empty tomorrow of its troubles. It empties today of its strengths. Wow. We're going to talk about that next week. what worrying really accomplishes. So that's next week. And that will probably be the final adult ed till after the summer. Because we are in, thank God, we are in camp mode. So Baruch Hashem, we're moving forward. We're more kids. Got another call today from mom who wants to sign three kids up. So we're still doing it. So anyway, all right. Have a great Shabbos, everyone. We'll see you next week. See you next Wednesday.
Just say it's not so.
What?
Just like to this week's Parsha, just say it's not so.
Not so. No. It's not so.
Good night. Good night, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.